Welcome to the, is it post Super Bowl yet? Third down, long? Is it over?
A minute left.
The very close to post Super Bowl edition of After Hours with Rick Kogan. Not a bad game. Not a bad game. It's my pleasure to have in here Kate Early and Eli Haver. Eli is a young co-president, one of the co-presidents of the Chicago Folklore Society. Kate is a former president of the Chicago Folklore Society, and they're here to talk about, and it really took me off guard. I thought, oh my God, 60 years. Because I'm sure, given my father's relationship with the U of C as a graduate and a devoted alumnus and his friendship with Studs Terkel, that I'm sure they dragged me there when I was too young to know what folk music was, but I don't remember it at all. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kate, how did you first get involved? As a student at the U of C?
Well, as a student, I got involved personally, but I would have to say that one of the reasons why I went to University of Chicago was to get involved in the Folklore Society.
Is that right?
Yeah, I am a local girl. I was born on the West Side,
where?
Grew up in the Austin neighborhood. Then we moved one block into the suburbs in Oak Park.
That
very
happened.
Fancy.
That happened at that time.
That's what I hear,
yeah.
And in fact, that's the case.
Yeah.
And the folk festival was being broadcast live on WFMT radio for many years, and then later highlights programs on
sure.
the station. And I'd be a little kid sitting in the hard wooden chair, kicking my feet, listening to the radio late at night, thinking, this is cool.
What drew you to folk music? When this started, the Old Town School started, I think, in 1957. And then along comes the folk festival. This is mm-hmm. at really the height of the folk music, mm-hmm. as they called it, boom in Chicago. Eli, you're so young. How old are you?
I'm 20 years old.
He's 20 years old. He's a student in anthropology at the University of Chicago. So this early stuff is probably out of your venue. But Kate, what was it about folk music at the time that drew you?
I think it was the stories, the ballads. Because, you know, when I first saw a few of them, the words written out, I stole my sister's Norton Anthology of English Literature, and in the early portion of the first volume, it has a couple of the old things, like Sir Patrick Spence, which is a well-known Scottish ballad about shipwrecks and magical, mystical stuff going on, and it made my hair stand on end. In fact, it's doing that right now, thinking about it.
Is that right?
Love that stuff. So,
what kind of musical taste did your parents have?
My father was a professional musician.
What sort?
He played the piano and sang popular music, a little jazz, a little blues, a little boogie-woogie.
In dance bands or small bands around
town?
He
was a solo artist. He played in nightclubs. He had a regular gig at a kind of bar and grill on State Street for many years, but he also played a couple of posh places like the Green Mill.
Really?
And Mr. Kelly's and Sasha's.
Wow, what was the place on State Street?
It was a restaurant with a German name that begins with S. My ancient boss lady used to go there when she was young.
I'm wondering if I went there.
Yeah,
when I was
so
young.
Dad was way into pop music.
Yeah,
but my mother had only one eardrum and was not musical in the least.
Oh, how interesting! And when you told your parents, mm-hmm. I want to go to the University of Chicago because I want to be part of the Folklore Society and participate in the folk festival. Your dad might have said, "That's great, Katie, go ahead," or not.
I didn't tell them I was going there for that reason. I told them that
it's a great school. It's
a great school, and I was going there for anthropology and social sciences.
Did you study anthropology as well? This is so interesting because in looking up some old clips about it, as I was just telling you before the show, Mike Fleischer, the guy who originally, whose idea I guess it was to even have a mm-hmm. folk festival in 1961, he was an anthropology student.
Mm-hmm.
So you're an anthropology student, Eli Haber. Why didn't you explain to me what the draw is for would-be anthropologists?
To the Folklore Society. That's
yeah.
a good question.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of a connection there is.
Yeah.
I
find it interesting, though, don't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I didn't come to the University of Chicago actually knowing that I would be interested in either of these things.
Huh.
Came in knowing I wanted to study linguistics, which I still am studying, as well
sure.
as anthropology. But then I kind of heard there was a group that was putting on this folk festival, thought I'd get involved, and that was a little more than a year ago, and here I am running the darn thing. And I mean, similarly, I kind of came into the school studying.
You literally would think. I know it's a knee jerk reaction, but you think to yourself, "Gee, a 20-year-old would only know folk music if he was Pete Seeger's grandson." Do you know what I mean? It does not seem any longer to be a fashionable musical genre. Would you both agree with that? I think sadly. But would you agree with that? What was it about the music and or the society that allowed Kate to twist your arm and become part of it?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I listen to a lot of folk derivative music and some what I would call actual folk music before I kind of came here. But I came here, started listening to some of the kinds of music that the fests usually has
traditionally
really,
done, yeah.
Yeah, bluegrass and Cajun and old time and all that sort of thing. I was a little bit more familiar with like Celtic music.
This is fascinating. I'm going to read you something that this is what your predecessor, Mr. Fleischer, is he still around, do you know?
He died a couple of years ago.
Sounds like a very interesting guy. He said to the Chicago Daily Tribune at the time, "Mass entertainment is murdering tradition and individualism. Time was when a youngster who wanted to hear music would learn to play the fiddle. He would keep the old ballads alive and make up new ones. Now he switches on TV or radio and gets commercial junk with nothing to it but rhythm." True then, but I think even truer now in this crazy internet age. Do you both not think?
We don't take quite that kind of antagonistic stance towards it. In fact, the internet has proved to be a pretty important thing to help preserve a lot of folk music. A lot of folk musicians are able to connect over the internet, promote themselves through the internet.
Yeah, good point. Kate, when did you get involved after you fooled your parents into believing the U of C was a vaunted academic institution?
Well, it actually is.
Oh, I'm aware of that.
Yes, Nobels are us, as the T-shirt says.
Tell me about it. I had a father who went there during the Robert Maynard Hutchins days,
right.
For goodness sake.
Wow.
But how did you get involved Folklore Society, which is the which puts on the folk festival, which is by the time you got there a couple decades old.
Yeah. Well, I was not involved during the fall quarter, possibly because I was, you know, still kind of spinning around like, oh my God, I got in here. All right. But then also I was not living on campus until January, which the festival was being held January end through February beginning that particular year, 1980. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, it's time for the festival. I'll get free tickets by being a T-shirt salesman, which is what I did.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. I was exposed to some music I hadn't heard too much before. But for me, oddly enough, the most noteworthy thing, the particular night that I went for the very first time in person, was the Chicago Electric Blues Band, Sons of the Blues, were playing.
Sure.
And they were doing an original song of theirs called Tear Down the Berlin Wall. This is January 1980. You know, less than 10 years later, that wall would come down.
Yeah.
And the crowd got all excited by this, and they were singing along and chanting. And the band just kept playing the refrain for like 20 minutes.
Oh, that sounds great.
Because everybody was totally there. Yeah, tear down the Berlin Wall! Wow.
Well, that's good because one of the foundational blocks of folk music is, to my mind, political activism. I am going to spend this entire hour with Kate Early and Eli Haber. They're here to talk about the Chicago Folklore Society, but more specifically, the 60th annual University of Chicago Folk Festival takes place February 14th and 15th. All you need to do, they have a beautiful poster, is go to www.uofcfolk.org. You got it. University of Chicago Folk, but just the U of FCFolk.org. We'll be back in a couple minutes. I'm here with Kate Early, former president of the Chicago Folklore Society, and Eli Haber, currently a co-president. Who's the other president?
Nicola Lustig, who's a current third year.
He's a what?
She's a current third year student as well. Undergrad.
There is obviously a tradition of having students be president and or co-presidents of this thing.
It's a student club.
Okay.
They're very nice and letting alumni like myself hang around.
I think it's a good thing you hang around, because I think one of the interesting things for me, certainly, knowing that on February 14th and 15th, maybe the 60th annual University of Chicago Folk Festival, is to have that. They need people like you there, Kate Early. The historical perspective is valuable. I love this quote from your angry, angry former president. But, I mean, even then you sense that there was this, the assault from other kinds of music. And I guess, you know, and one of the seminal things that you may not, you're a little young, remember was, you know, the folk boom was massive in this time with the Weavers and certainly Pete Seeger, part of the Weavers, and the Old Town School of Folk Music and the Earl of Old Town eventually starting. And then Dylan in, I guess, 65 going all. Dylan was seen as the new god of folk music until he picked up an electric guitar in Newport in 1965, and then was the onslaught of rock and roll. I have some people I've talked to, friends of mine, saying, talking about the continuing importance of folk music, and I think the Folklore Society and it punctuated by the Folk Festival does that. It's. When you think of world music, folk is world music. Now, that first one, Kate Early, you have a rare, they didn't have CDs at the time, you have a rare CD of that first folk festival, which, of course, Studs, who you could put an arm on for almost anything. He was the softest touch in the world. Let's listen to a little of it. What is it, Studs introducing something?
Introducing the first concert of the first night of the first U of C Folk Festival on, I believe it was February 3rd, 1960.
Wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first annual University of Chicago Folk Festival. George, if you please.
So we say, Scots, Wahey, we Wallace bled.
That's Studs.
And this is the event tonight that Mike told you about, the first annual Folk Song Festival, University of Chicago Folklore Society sponsoring it. It's rather unique. It's a first, but in a more important way, it's a first because the kind of music, singing, and storytelling here tonight is not beautiful, not pretty in the accepted sense. It is beautiful in a very raw sense. Because many of the singers you will hear are indigenous, in that the music they sing, the stories they tell, are part of the very warp and woos of the very lives. It was Alan Lomax who said there's no such thing as American national folk music. There's Virginia folk music, there's New Orleans folk music, there's Kentucky folk music, there's Canadian folk music, and we'll hear singers from all quarters of the country and of our northern neighbors too, and from places as far off and exotic and distant as the Old Town School of Folk Music. And the introductions are going to be mercifully brief because there are a great many artists on tonight. We open immediately with a group of young singers, but they're more than singers, they're collectors and they're scholars whose love for a certain kind of music has resulted in a revival of this music known as bluegrass, music of the mountain country, the southern Appalachian country, that has had a fantastic resurgence, particularly on campuses throughout the country. Almost every campus has its bluegrass band, as well as its Dixieland or modern jazz band. It's even more popular. And in no small way to the work of three young artists who are urban trained, yet the love of the music of the 20s and 30s of the mountains has come forth in their recordings and in their appearances. I refer, of course, to Mike Seeger, to Tom Paley, Johnny Cohn, the new Lost City Rats.
That is a certifiably Studs Terkel speaking there. It warms my heart, too. He's my father's best friend, and he was something of a second father to me. And so philosophically, the Folklore Society decided to put on a folk festival that addressed the astonishing diversity and ethnicity of folk music. And it's kept true to that mission ever since. Kate, when you took over as president, was it, you know, by then the Earl was still going strong. How was it booking the thing? What was the prevailing notion of folk music? Because I think kind of the definition, certainly with the public at large, has changed over the years. What was it when you were running the joint, as they say, as a student in 1980?
Well, because I was in the Chicago area, and Chicago in the 70s and 80s was a powerhouse for singer-songwriters.
John Prine, Steve Goodman, Bonnie Prine.
They were all there. They were all active. I went to hear lots of them live. And that's all fabulous. And they are, shall we say, the traditional music of the future. But down at U of C, we were trying to bring to the stage, and we always have, I mean, even now when it's more challenging to do so,
sure, to
bring to the stage people who don't really like get out of their neighborhood or get out of their particular circle.
Sure.
You know, one example for this year is the Mariachi Sirenas, a women's mariachi band. You know, they're going to be on probably the biggest stage they've been on so far, I'm guessing.
They've been on the same stage before, actually.
Oh, okay. But also other bands at other times. Medicine Line, a young lady who is a Métis, a person who was a mixed-race person between Native American and, you know, English, Irish, Scottish, and French up in the Canadian borderline area, but
yeah,
on the U.S. side.
Oh.
And they play music a little bit differently than they do in Quebec or in Ireland, but it's all related.
Do they feel then and now, Eli Haber, do they feel flattered to be part of this? Do they feel anxious, excited? Are they aware of the tradition of the folk festival?
I think some people are, some people maybe aren't. We don't have quite the maybe name brand recognition that we did 20, 30, 40 years
sure.
ago. It also varies with the artists. Some have been here many times before, and some have never been here before. Some are more, I guess, closer to the circles that we that are aware of the festival, while some are from traditions that maybe haven't come to the festival before. For instance, Métis. I don't know if we've had very much Métis fiddle music, but
yeah,
I'm really glad that we have it this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, the lineup is, to me, terribly exciting, including Patrick Lynch of the Chicago Pipe Bank. I'm going to keep talking to Kate Early and Eli Haber about the 60th Annual University of Chicago Folk Festival, not only durable, but I think addresses the still and ever vibrant world of folk music. That is, in a way, Eli, and you mentioned it, so much more accessible than it was, okay, when we were kids, going to a record store. Maybe it was on the radio. Now it's you can access it everywhere. We got to take a break and then get some commercials, but you're going to stay on all the way until the end of this hour, and we'll play. Kate was nice enough to bring some samples of music of the performers who were going to be there this year. Go to www.uofcfolk.org. We'll be right back. I am having a great time on After Hours here talking to Kate Early and Eli Haber. Kate, the former president, and Eli, one of the current co-presidents of the Chicago Folklore Society, talking about the 60th Annual University of Chicago Folk Festival, which takes place February 14th and 15th on the campus of the University of Chicago. There is some free music. There are dance workshops. There are concerts. Describe it, Eli. It's a whole weekend to dive into if you are of a mind and have the time.
Yeah, so we have two nights of concerts on the Friday and the Saturday night. Friday night concert starts at 8 p.m. and goes till 11:30 midnight. And then the following day, we start up again at 10 a.m. through 5 p.m. with workshops all day long. We have a whole building rented out at the university on the campus that has usually four workshops running simultaneously. You can learn to sing sea shanties or play the hurdy-gurdy or dance four or five different kinds of folk dances. And then a couple hours following that, we have our concluding concert, which starts at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday the 15th.
And ends at like 2 a.m., I'm
Something
sure.
Something like that.
Let me ask you, over the years, because, Kate, you go back to about 1980, who comes to the folk festival? Is it the same people who lament the fact that Bonnie Kolak doesn't play as much as she used to, or will sit home and listen to John Prine records all day because he doesn't perform here as much as he used to? I would think, on some level, tell me I'm wrong, that there are people coming who are trying or gently trying to pass along their affection for this music to kids.
I think that is correct. I would have to say, and this is a pretty widespread problem in the folk music world, at least in the U.S., the age of the folk audience is going up. It's now like 55 through death.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why the afternoon things on Saturday are for free and we have stuff for kids. And, you know, if you bring a kid, of course, be aware of where he or she is, but they will be exposed to stuff that may make them as excited as I was as a little kid growing up in Oak Park.
Listen to the radio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Eli, your first year, were you a part of this whole thing last year at school?
I was, yeah.
And what did you expect and what did you get?
I didn't really know what to expect. I just basically heard that there was a group on campus that was doing things related to folk music, and I thought I'd check it out. And what I found was this small little group of students and alumni. It was really just a couple of us last year. It's grown a little bit this year. That got together once a week in the basement of this building off on the corner of campus that's strewn with decades of stuff. And
so you do have a headquarters, so to speak.
And we would talk about folk music and different acts that we would bring to the fest for an hour and a half every Wednesday night. And it gradually built into this incredible event that I didn't even realize how big or kind of unique it was until I actually was there.
You know, it actually must be unique now. Mm-hmm. There may indeed be some other institution. I mean, you still have the Old Town School, which is doing what the Old Town School does, which is a lot of concerts, but also a lot of teaching. But I think what you're doing at a university is probably unique in the university world. I don't know of any other. Do you?
Yes.
Well, there, of course, there is one that's, you know everything.
I do.
I know.
There is one university-based student-run folk festival in North America that is older than us, and they do lean on traditional, although they also do singer-songwriter, and that's up at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland.
Oh, it's too hard to get to.
It's
a bit
of a ways.
You can't draw the crowd that you can in Hyde Park.
Right.
There.
Yeah, we do actually get people in from about five or six states.
Do you really?
Yeah.
And do you get some people in who have been, I would suppose, regulars for decades?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And what do they tell you? What do they tell you? Do they, you know, because, you know, U of C crowd can be a very opinionated and occasionally, judging by those friends of my father's, not he, but friends of my father's, sort of opinionated and bossy. Do they try, you guys are students running this thing, do they try to impose upon you their philosophy of what this should be?
Only occasionally. I think there are some old-timers who have particular ideas about what the festival should be like and what folk music should be. And we take those ideas very, very seriously, but we can't. We all do have to move forward with the times while kind of keeping close to our roots of bringing traditional folk music to the Mandelhall stage. And we can't necessarily please everyone, although we do try pretty darn hard.
Yeah, I'll bet. I mean, just this this, you've got people out of Johnson City, Tennessee. You've got bluegrass people. You got the mariachi thing. Sounds absolutely fabulous.
They're great.
Where are they? They're based here.
In Chicago, yeah.
Really, but they generally play, they're in a very small, not small venues, but they don't get the exposure that one might desire.
I think they're relatively new. They don't have a website yet. They've been around for a couple of years, I know, and they have played some neighborhood festivals.
That's good. I'll tell you my great, we have all the time in the world, my great, Dan heard this about 15 times, but my great definition of a folk singer is the great Fred Holstein, who was one of the, he and his brother Ed, who's still around, a staple at the Earl of Old Town. Fred was a great singer. He didn't write many songs, but he was, many other songwriters loved to have Fred Holstein play his music. So about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago before Fred died, Charles Osgood and Jules Eberhard, who were great fans of his, collected from somewhere a bunch of old tapes of Fred recorded live. Mm-hmm. And they put it together and they somehow made a CD. And Fred had the CD and told me about it, and I found the CD, and I had Fred on a radio show I had years ago, and played music and talked to Fred about what it was like to be a folk singer and how he sometimes drank too much when he got on stage, and he's a lovely guy. But the best part of the whole thing was I said, no, Fred, people can get your CD by just going to your website. Rick, I don't got no website. I go, well, no, see, you do, Fred. People can order your CD at www.fredholstein.com. No, Rick, don't mislead the people. Don't mislead anybody. I don't got a website. I don't really. I don't know. I guess you could buy it in a store or something. So I finally, after about 5 minutes, I said, Fred, you do have a website. You do. And I said, Jules and Charlie Osgood made you a website, and you can get... Oh wow! Yeah, maybe. I guess I do, Rick. What I don't got is a computer. And I thought that is just my such a lovely definition of Fred Holstein. But that was just one of the things. And it's hard, you know, given the definition of folk. I think in a lot of people's minds, it's really trapped back in the '60s, and it's trapped back in the Pete Seeger days. But I think what you're doing down here is showing its vibrancy, and probably what you've been doing since 1982, Kate, right?
1980.
Yeah, 1980.
Yeah. Well, I was mentioning earlier that this is an opportunity to share a lot of the different kinds of music from the different kinds of people that are here in the U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, I was saying I don't like the idea of an American melting pot, which would indicate that everything gets lumped together and then it's all the same at the end. I don't like us to be like that. I prefer to think of it as an American mosaic, mm-hmm. where you still have your own identity, but you are within America. And so, you know, you have both.
This Jimmy Bro of Lafayette, Louisiana sounds very interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Tell me about him, Eli.
He's I've been lucky enough to be the one kind of coordinating with him personally, and he's a lovely guy. He actually fits the description you just gave very, very well. He's super, super friendly. I've talked to him over the phone, but he's also very kind of low tech. He's not like super old, but he has I think a flip phone and maybe a computer, but no printer. So the times I've had to email him forms for him to fill out, his contract and all that, he's needed to go to the local Office Depot and then have it sent to me through the scanner there.
I think that's great, though. he is one of the best Cajun accordionists of the modern era.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Has he recorded?
He for a long time played with a group called Beau Soleil.
Okay, that sounds vaguely familiar. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They've won some awards. They're a really kind of wonderful
group. Is he excited to be coming here?
Absolutely.
Let's play something of his.
Yeah,
there's a selection called Iota Two Step, and that's just him playing solo. It's fantastic.
That sounds fantastic. And he sounds like my kind of folk guy.
Absolutely.
Eli, that's like my kind of folk guy. Thank you. on News Nation on the edge of my chair for that. I have a few more minutes with Kate Early, a former president, and Eli Haber, a current co-president of the Chicago Folklore Society, talking about the 60th annual University of Chicago Folk Festival, which they have certainly, if they haven't done a good enough job of convincing you to go sample this thing, then I'm going to write a story for next Sunday in the Tribune that I think, I hope, will finish the job. Your own enthusiasm about it and your own passion about it is really palpable and should be catching. What else? I'm curious. What else does the Folklore Society do beyond this and meeting in the weird basement corner of Hyde Park? This is your main effort, is it not?
It is, yeah. The other thing we do regularly is we host once or twice a quarter, so once every month or two, we'll have a contra dance just on campus, but people from all around Chicago will come and dance with us. And we also actually just a couple days ago had an event that we called the UChicago Student Folk Showcase, where we have students who play folk music and folk adjacent music come and just play in a coffee shop on campus for other students.
Oh,
and
great.
Helps promote the fest as well.
How do you like the U of C?
I love it. I think it's wonderful.
And how did you like it, Kate Early?
Loved it and hated it simultaneously.
Yeah, I've heard.
But I realized later that it was because I had a big chip on my shoulder about whether I was good enough to go there.
Hmm.
Well, okay, I was there.
Yeah.
So I got over it.
And you graduated. Did you ever have Norman McLean as a professor?
No.
Norman McLean, legendarily a professor at the University of Chicago, mm-hmm. who after he won like Teacher of the Century Award like four or five times. He was a good friend of my father's and a lovely man. And then after he retired and his wife died, he sat down and wrote A River Runs Through It, mm-hmm. Which is a magnificent, magnificent book. Give me both of you from slightly different perspectives state of the health of folk music in this world.
You want to start?
You're looking at me.
As you know it.
As
you feel it.
Based on what I understand and experience, the folk boom was a great thing in the 50s and 60s. Then it started getting a little kind of glossy and glitzy, and there were bands that were fun, but they were definitely making it slick. We don't like slick in the Folklore Society, not so much. Unless it's slick for a purpose, like Bill and the Bells, or last year the Fat Babies doing early jazz and blues. Every once in a while, we'll get a big boost of interest because there will be something like the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Sure,
or
sure.
More recently, the Ken Burns country music documentaries.
No question.
You know, I'm watching this series and I'm thinking, oh my God, so many of these early country artists appeared on our stage in the 1960s. You know, like members of the Carter family.
Yeah.
Ralph Stanley, Bill Monroe. A lot of those guys were on our stage and we brought them to Chicago.
It seems to me, and Eli, I want to hear from you too, a very weird time for music in general. God's sake, when artists, there is no such thing. Used to make an album, and it was a sort of a narrative to the album, and that doesn't exist anymore because everything's downloadable, and you're making your own albums on the thing. It's a weird. I can't figure out contemporary music at all. But you are right, Eli, in that if one wants to explore folk, it is much easier to do thanks to the internet, is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's sort of a mixed deal. On the one hand, if you go purely by our ticket sales, then the popularity of folk music is declining. But I don't know if that's the best metric, because another aspect of that is maybe there's just other things that people want to do in addition to liking folk music. And if you do like want to like folk music and get into it, as I've done, and as you just mentioned, it's now so easy to do. If you want to, it's all there. You can find recordings of all these folk traditions that maybe even 20, 30 years ago you couldn't have found much information about at all. So, and the traditions are still alive. I have I had friends back home in Boston who grew up going to fiddle camps every summer.
Yeah. it's like, I mean, you can be your own kind of Alan Lomax now without mm-hmm. getting out of your getting off your couch. Alan mm-hmm. Lomax famously went around and captured and cataloged music around the country.
Well, you can even listen to 35 years of University of Chicago folk festivals if you go to the Harold Washington Public Library Music Center, because we received the gift from FMT of all of these ancient tapes, and then we raised some money to remaster them, and you can hear some of these things. That's where the CD came from that I brought this evening.
That's amazing. Also, you can go to, you know, WFMT and hear mm-hmm. Studs Terkel's old show. You
should hear. I think that's now lodged at the History Museum.
It's such a weird website. Google Studs Terkel Archive, and you will get a number of his shows.
Yeah.
Speaking of young folk singers, my favorite of all, he had 5,000 shows, and they've now archived about 2,000. The greatest show, to my mind, that is available for your listening pleasure is Studs interviewing the 22-year-old Bob Dylan.
Wow.
On his first visit to Chicago, he played a nameless club. He had one album out. And Dylan is certifiably the Dylan we have all come to know and not understand. The inscrutable, crazy man. But Studs browbeats him into, he says, Bob, if he could play a song here. I see a guitar on the floor there. It's on the floor. If he could get it out and play a song, or one of the songs on the album. And Dylan's like, well, you know, if it'd be better if you played it on the disc, meaning the record, I guess. It'd sound better. Man, but no, I'd love to. Once you do it, I'd like to see your face while you play, and blah, blah, blah. Goes back and forth like this until Dylan does, and you can hear it in the show, take out his guitar and play Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And it is spine-tingling. And Studs then makes him play more songs. I mean, it's one of the great things. If you Google Bob Dylan, Studs Terkel, you will be able to find this. Studs, how long did Studs MC the thing? You would think forever almost, right?
Well, for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And then things changed. Eventually, the students have been the MCs and have done an excellent job by and large.
Are you going to do it this year, Eli Haber?
Be sure to tell some jokes, Eli.
I may borrow a couple from you.
Yeah. I was going to say Bob Dylan actually got involved in the jam sessions at the early University of Chicago Folk Festival, I think in 61.
Yeah, it would be during this trip when he did Studs' show. Yeah.
Yeah. Nina Hellstein is a Hyde Park neighbor. And also an adjunct assistant to the Folklore Society. And Nina has come to meetings and, you know, she has said, yeah, I heard him jamming in the hallways at Ida Noyes during the weekend of the festival.
Wow.
Most people didn't recognize him. It was like,
yeah,
cool.
Because, well, he did one album out and there was no mass media the way there is now. And he's just Bob Dylan. He's the voice, the new voice of folk music. What do you plan to do? You got any plans for post-graduation there, young man?
I don't really know yet. I'm still sort of figuring that out.
Kate, what did you do? What did you wind up doing?
I ended up going into association work. I worked for a shared friend, Studs Terkel. My old boss was Ruth Adams at the MacArthur Foundation.
Sure.
And then later I went to the American College of Surgeons and worked there. I just recently took early retirement after 20 years.
One of the most amazing buildings in Chicago, is it not?
I think you're thinking of the International.
The International one.
I was at the American.
And what has kept you? What has kept you tied to the young people of the Chicago Folklore Society and the Folk Festival all these decades?
Their courtesy. I don't know.
But it's ongoing. It's ongoing fun for you. Do you have other alumni?
Yeah, quite
still,
a few.
Oh, you do? Still involved? Mm-hmm. Are there any perks for former presidents or what?
Free T-shirt.
You still sell these T-shirts at these things?
Yeah, free tickets, too.
It is free tickets. I mean, they might as well be free. They're so reasonably priced. They're, you know, for the concerts, $25, $30, $20, $25 for seniors, $10 for students, and then all sorts of free events during the day that they can partake of. I mean, it's, you know, it gets a little chilly in February, ladies and gentlemen, and it's Valentine's Day, and I can think of many, many less lively and enlightening things than going to the 60th annual University of Chicago Folk Festival. February 14th and 15th. For all sorts of information, go to www.uofcfolk.org. Or just Google, you know, University of Chicago Folk Festival. That's why I lament the internet sometimes, but that's what Google's good for. You just put Suds Turco, Bob Dylan, you'll have an hour of really, really astonishing listening. Thank you to both very much. I may be in touch later.
Great, of course.
I'm going to write something. And thanks for all the cool pictures, too. Kate, Kate sent me a bunch of pictures over the years, some shot by some notable, notable folk musicians. But good luck with this whole thing, and we'll talk. We'll talk.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure. It's really my pleasure. We'll be back after a couple commercials or whatever we do here, and then we'll have some more guests because it's a full show. I hope you like the Super Bowl. We'll be back. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. Thanks for listening to some folk music. It is now my pleasure to welcome into the studio Jacqueline Hayes, who I've known for some time. Lucha Moro, who I have admired for many, many years as a writer and critic. Heather Eidson, is that right, Heather? Eidson?
It's Eidson.
Eidson is a photographer. All of them are involved in something that you, Jacqueline Hayes, started many years ago called the Chicago Help Initiative. I have ever been intrigued by this charitable operation, is that what you like to call it?
Yeah, it's a nonprofit. Yes, yeah. You're right.
What motivated you? It focuses on an area that many people would think, oh man, there are no homeless people here, sort of the downtown area, Chicago River Lake.
Well, I like to give you a brief history of the Chicago Help Initiative.
I'm sure people would like to hear that.
In November of 1999, the city closed Lower Wacker Drive to the homeless, and a lot of them started living in the doorways of spaces on Michigan Avenue. And I am a retail broker, and I do retail leasing on Michigan Avenue and Oak Street. And they were living in the doorways of the spaces I was trying to lease. And I said, get the heck out of here.
Yeah.
You're going to hurt my business. And then after that was over, I felt a little guilty about doing that because I thought this is where they felt safe. And here I'm kicking them out of that.
Yeah.
So I gathered together.
Well, a lot of people, you know, there is that whole guilt thing that people feel when they do that, but they don't take the next step. They just don't walk in those areas anymore.
Yeah. So I gathered together a group of organizations from the Greater North Michigan Avenue Association, which is the Magnificent Mile Association now, Holy Name, Fourth Press, Catholic Charities, River North, SOAR,
is that your
Northwestern
phone? Someone's calling for help.
Northwestern Hospital, etc.
Yeah, and were they eager to collaborate
Absolutely.
With you,
Absolutely.
Or were they because kind of like it's none of your business?
The situation was really very unattractive to everybody.
Sure.
And they all wanted to do something, and so we met together for a year and created a two-sided card that could be handed out to a homeless person to tell them what to do to get help. And after, it took us 1 year, meeting once a month, to create that card. And after it was over, they suggested that we should do some housing. And I thought, holy cow, it took us a year to do a two-sided card. I can imagine how long it would take us to do housing. And fortunate for me and Chicago Help Initiative, we were very blessed. Monsignor Boland, who was the president of Catholic Charities at the time, offered me his dining hall at Catholic Charities. And our first meal was served in March of 2001. Mark Schulman, when it was Eli's Place for Steak
on Chicago Avenue,
was my first meal provider, and he continues doing it all these years as well.
Well, a lot of restaurants. I've been to that Wednesday thing, and there are now a number of restaurants.
Oh, absolutely. Restaurants and hotels. And then what happened is that when an individual would come to a meal, they'd say, hey, can we make a donation? So they'll give us a donation. We will pay a restaurant to provide it and stuff like that.
Well, it's really one of Chicago's, it's a remarkable story in Chicago, and one that, as much as you would hope, well, after 10 years, wow, there are no homeless people, it's even worse.
Well, it's almost 20 years.
Yeah.
But the thing that really happened is that there are a lot of places that feed people, But we ended up, through our experience with the guests that we feed, we ended up seeing that they needed other things.
Well, you're a social service agency. It's not just here's a free meal or here's a dollar.
Because we have all kinds of programs that really instills in them a sense of self-worth.
Yeah.
And actually makes them stand up taller and really crave to get off the streets.
Now, I know that that the Chicago Help Initiative has been covered in, you know, for various TV spots and little stories and Harry Porterfield, people you should know kind of thing. When did the idea surface? And it's about time, frankly, to make a documentary. When did you, for instance, get a hold? Go ahead.
Yes, it's a wonderful story.
Oh, it's a great story.
Well, what it this happened almost a year ago. It was March of 2019, and I was showing my documentary, a separate documentary called Francis Xavier Cabrini, The People Saint, which I wrote and directed in 2017. It honors the great humanitarian patroness of immigrants. We were showing the film at Assumption Church, because we do take the film around and we tour it and host discussions. And Jacqueline Hayes was at that screening.
Well, I arranged to get it.
Yes, and afterwards, you know, Jacqueline has a very persuasive manner about
her.
No
question.
No, and she
pleasantly persuasive.
She reeled me in and approached me immediately afterwards and said, you know, Lucia, would you consider, you know, creating a documentary about homelessness in Chicago and the many facets of it, including Chicago Help Initiative and our partners. And I just thought the idea was much needed for our times.
No question. I think another reason for it is, you know, okay, the homelessness, which I've been covering, I don't know, for 40 years, it will spike when they move people off Lower Wacker. My God, look at all the homeless people who live here. It will spike when something noteworthy or bad happens. Rarely is it good. And then it will fade from the pages and coronavirus will take its place or something else will take its place. And it is hardly a problem and a shame that has gone away. It's gotten worse.
Well, and I think, too, with our film, I was certainly struck by how the Chicago Help Initiative nourishes the whole person. And
and
that's where our approach is certainly, like, nourishing and taking a holistic approach where we're really showing a great amount of respect in understanding who the individuals are who are experiencing homelessness and what are the many different reasons, how many people could just be a breath away from homelessness.
Well, there's so many. There are people, you know, as I met at Catholic Charities, there are people who are a paycheck, people and
Absolutely.
Families
mm-hmm.
who
Absolutely.
Are one paycheck away from homelessness.
Right.
We have to take a short little break here, but we'll come back and talk to, we'll find out how Heather has gotten involved in with you two dynamos in a couple of minutes. I'll tell you first that Chicago Knows Best, right? Hit up Facebook, tell Chicago, oh, this isn't even for me. I don't have anything. Go.
This is a Jackson Hewitt Tax Service announcement. Did you buy or sell a home, get married, or have a child last year? Maybe you even started a side gig. Then you've got a reason to go to Jackson Hewitt. Because when life changes, so do your taxes. And that's when things can get complicated. At Jackson Hewitt, we know that those events could mean big tax breaks or a higher tax bill. That's why our tax pros make sure your taxes are done right, no matter how your life has changed. Remember, when life changes, so do your taxes. So go to Jackson Hewitt today and let us help you. That's Jackson Hewitt.
Message and data rates may apply.
Guys, got hair loss? I know what you're thinking. Should I shave my head, comb it over, wear a hat? Just stop. This isn't 1970. Keep your hair and your confidence because Bosley, America's number one hair restoration expert, can give you your real, natural-looking hair back permanently. They're giving away an absolutely free information kit and a free gift card to everyone who texts MORE to 85850. Dude, you don't have to look like your dad because this isn't your dad's hair loss treatment. People all over the country trust Bosley because they use the latest technology to give you your real hair back. You wash it. You cut it. It's your own real, naturally growing hair. And the best part, Bosley's permanent solution is protected by the Bosley Guarantee. Let them show you for free how awesome your hair could look with an absolutely free information kit and a gift card for $250 off. Text MORE to 85850. That's MORE to 85850.
Liberty Mutual Insurance Company presents.
Lebo, Lebo.
Doug.
Welcome to Burger Palace. What would you like today?
Yes, I'd like to tell you that Liberty Mutual customizes your car insurance so you only pay for what you need.
This is Burger Palace. Do you want any food?
Yes, one palace party meal.
No, Limu, they won't put insects on a burger.
No, you can't talk to the manager.
Liberty, 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 liberty.
Only pay for what you need at libertymutual.com.
For news at 10, watch WGN. Micah Mateer, Joe Donlin, Dan Rohn, and Chicago's most trusted meteorologist, Tom Skilling. For TV news at 10, watch Chicago's very own WGN.
I'm with Jacqueline Hayes, the founder of the Chicago Help Initiative 20 years ago. Go to ChicagoHelpInitiative.org. It's a lovely website. You can get a lot of information there. Lucho Moro is now a filmmaker who, but once was one of the great and talented arts writers and critics in this town. And we were talking about Jacqueline saw and arranged for Lucha, before you even met her, to have a screening of a documentary that she had made, and now you two are collaborating on a documentary. And Heather, how are you involved?
That's a great question. I first met Jacqueline Hayes, I think, back in 2015. I was working at Loyola University Chicago as a multimedia producer, and I was working on a photography project, so we were photographing some of our awardees and trying to find events in which they were working within social justice.
Oh.
And so Jackie happened to be at this Loyola School of Law's event that I was photographing, and it was at the Lawson House for a monthly dinner she did called Jackie's Place.
Yeah.
And she introduced herself to me and just lured me in, and I started volunteering for a good 5 years. I taught a digital storytelling class at the Chicago Help Initiative, and from there, a couple years later, a few years later, fast forward, last year, I got a call and from Jackie, who said, I met Lucia Morrow and I want her to make a documentary about the Chicago Help Initiative, and I think we should all have lunch, and I'd like you to be involved. And I had to rack my brain. I said, how do I know Lucia Morrow? And it turns out that Lucia and I had talked on the phone, because I would often have to coordinate the photography for Loyola Magazine, and we were doing a feature on Lucia, who was her first film, In My Brother's Shoes, and we just talked on the phone for a few times for what must have been like an hour each time, and we're just kindred spirits.
We really connected.
Oh, this whole thing seems so beautifully serendipitous.
The ultimate in harmonic convergence.
Yeah,
right?
No kidding.
There's something even stranger. We discovered that her father was Sicilian, my father was Sicilian, her mother was Polish, my mother was Polish. She grew up in Norwood Park, I grew up in Norwood Park. My father
Our fathers at one time worked for Brock's.
Oh,
so we know each other in another life.
Wow.
That's just amazing.
Heather, you're kind of out of that loop, right?
I'm out of that loop.
You're out of that loop.
You know, I probably could have documented it or document
the
homecoming.
You know, Jackie, you are as persuasive as you can be. You're a relatively self-effacing person, I think. And so this documentary is certainly not about, wow, look what Jacqueline Hayes has done. And that, it's easy to fall into that because she is a dynamic personality too, Lucia. Yeah. When you conceptualize the movie, what were some of the guiding principles for both of you in making this film?
Well, for both of us, it was really highlighting the individuals, both those who have experienced homelessness, are formerly homeless or currently, and where they are in their life, how they got there, how they're moving forward, as well as the volunteers, all the individuals who assist, but then how they work together and how both groups enrich each other. We want to, you know, the name of the documentary is called I Have a Name.
Oh,
so the goal is for us to recognize that those experiencing homelessness are not nameless. They're individuals. They have
ideas and thoughts.
Well,
they're also not faceless. I mean, that's what you see around this town all the time, is people looking directly through
them. Right.
They have a story. And here's what's so beautiful. It's how we, all of us, humanity, can not only make a difference, but how all those individuals, no matter what what troubles they may have or circumstances, they're enriching our lives. I think that's ultimately what we're showing. We're really empowering everyone in this film.
How many people are featured in the film? Roughly.
We conducted about close to 30 interviews. Wow. And
were there any, did you come across anybody who did not want to be a part of it? You know, because there are some who I have met in my various roles who don't want to tell their story.
Well, one, I did find that there were guests who didn't necessarily want to share their story or how they got to where they're at. But they would love to, in very, very articulate in terms of what they're gaining from the arts and culture experience or from the book club and the and sharing their ideas and opinions. So if someone didn't necessarily want to go back to that very difficult place or time, it was okay because here we're in the moment. What's happening in your life now? Everyone was treated with a great deal of respect.
Sure.
And
well, that was important. I mean, that's the rock of the foundation of what you did.
You're absolutely right.
Because you yourself, Jacqueline Hayes, when you were, you know, sort of, I don't know whether you kicked these people and said, "Get out of the doorway. I've got to sell this. I've got to sell this business," and you felt guilty because, and I think you did because your encounter was closer than most people would have. And then you began to respect, and you saw that these people were human beings.
Yeah.
And so that is what wants to be, I think, reflected in the film. Mm-hmm. Heather, you're a good photographer. I've seen your website. It's
thank you.
You go to Photo Shield. It's Heather, E-I-D-S-O-N, it's the last name. Your photos going to be part of this, too?
Yes. Yeah, I've been really grateful and fortunate to be able to be on the set during some of the filming. And so not only have I documented the filming as it's taken place, but I also have had plenty of times and opportunities to photograph the Chicago Help Initiative meals and then some other events, an organization called Harmony, Hope, and Healing, which we're also going to be including in the documentary. So they provide music therapy for those in need. And it's just been just truly a gratifying experience to be able to have access, you know, to not just the organization, but to have people allow me to document them.
Well, I'm sure they're
going to be involved in the editing, too.
And the editing.
I'm sure there are a lot of organizations who would love to screen this movie. And I am sure that Chicago at ChicagoHelpInitiative.org, you will have information about that. I certainly plan to write about the film before it premieres.
Thank you.
My pleasure. What you have to hope that on a really visceral level, this gives people a much, in 1 hour, a much deeper understanding of that word that is so abused and so misconstrued and so ill-defined, homelessness.
What we want to see happen is that we become a blueprint for how other people should help the homeless and or disadvantaged. Chicago Help Initiative, through one of our volunteers a number of years ago, moved to California, came back to Chicago, lives in Bucktown. She goes to Holy Trinity Church in Bucktown.
Sure.
And so we now have expanded our services and brought it down there. We're ready to do that elsewhere. But we also want them to understand that there are a lot of organizations or places where people can go for food, but they need the rest of it.
Yeah, that's the. I think that is the crucial element here, to understand that yes, food feeds the body and gives sustenance to the body, but what about the soul and what about the kids and what about the profession and what about the ego and what about the self-esteem?
That's the whole thing.
And all of that stuff. Lucia, this is a. In both of you, Heather and Lucia, this woman is a hero.
And a force. Yes, quite a bit in a force. Absolutely. I mean, and I think what Jackie is is firm in a sense, and in really will persist in bringing people together, but in quite a gentle way. You know, I think, and I feel I will say this, and Heather has captured this so beautifully in her photographs, and certainly our crew and everyone, that at particularly the Wednesday meals at Chicago Help Initiative, it's a very much of a family environment. It's an oasis. So all the guests who come, they're safe. They're free to be who they are. Yep. They're not on guard. You know, I think there would be a lot of issues of trust. But the amount of hugging that happens and all the activities, there are the art classes, the photography classes, book club, job training, computer skills, chair yoga.
The other part of it, too, is that the people who come and help serve the food, these are people like Mark I've seen it happen. Yeah. And these are people like Mark Shulman and people who run restaurants and people who have lives beyond, as far beyond pain as you can get.
Yeah.
But that interaction is, I think, crucial for all of them.
Mm-hmm. Community is very important.
Yeah.
Both sides.
Yeah. It's very symbiotic. I think that there's a give and take, and nobody's saying, I'm helping you. I think everyone is helping one another.
I think the people who are serving the food, you can see it. They're getting more out of it than the people eating the food,
I've often wondered who gets more out of it, the volunteer or the guest.
Same here. Jackie Hayes, you were a force of nature, dear. You were a force of nature,
I adore you for that. I'm surrounded by people that are...
they feel it. They feel it. Lucia, it's great to see you. Heather, it's great to meet you. I cannot wait. Please keep me posted on the film. I can't wait to write about it.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Get home safe. Get home safe, ladies, because it's a crazy world out there. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back. This is a full show, and I like this. Damn, we haven't had a full show in a long time. But it's a good one, and it's going to end with a half hour with my great old friend and a guy I admire tremendously, Jerry Nicosia. Jerry, how are you?
Be here. Thank you, Rick.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's a hell of a book, but then I've been a fan of your writing forever. Jerry is a kid who grew up, if I can make the leap, at Lowell, Massachusetts, and Lyons, Illinois, are two vastly different places, but you and Jack Kerouac, whom you've had a long relation with, kind of shared similarities in your childhood, didn't you?
Well, Lyons, Illinois isn't all that different from Lowell. I mean, it's a working-class town. It was a little bit depressed when I was growing up, and Lowell was a little bit depressed when Kerouac was growing up. I came from an ethnic family. I mean, I was Italian-American Catholic. He was French-Canadian-American Catholic. I had a poor father, a working mailman father. His father was a printer. So, a lot of the sort of Catholic working-class background, feeling an outsider to, academia and all the higher levels of the world, I shared a lot of that I understood Kerouac.
Yeah, I think you did. We will talk about the depth of Jerry Nicosia's understanding and his your latest book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century, is an upbeat book, Jerry, even though it deals with some really nasty people. But before all that, when did you first encounter Kerouac the way I did with the volume called On the Road?
No, not at all. I loved books and poetry and writing since I was a kid. I had an honors English class my junior year at Morton West, where a guy named Andy Bisou was the teacher, really turned me on to literature. All we did for a whole year at Morton West was read great books, Walden and just the Scarlet Letter. Well, 1 year of great books, that really turned me on to literature. But and then I went to the University of Illinois in Chicago, what they used to call Circle Campus.
Where I went for a short time.
Undergraduate English education, and then went back for graduate school, master's in English and American literature. But Kerouac was not taught in any of those classes, And I hadn't read him. I mean, I I grew up a pretty straight, as I said, Catholic, American, middle class, lower middle class kid. I wasn't a hippie. I mean, I was anti-war. I was very much anti-Vietnam War, but I didn't have long hair, and I wasn't out smoking dope every night. I mean, I was working hard as a college student. And when I was a graduate student in 1972, I was a teaching assistant to help pay my way through graduate school, and I was sharing an office with a hip kid from Harvard who was always we were teaching assistants. I was sharing an office, and he was always taunting me that I hadn't read Kerouac. You know, and when he found out I hadn't read Kerouac, he would drop Kerouac's name in the conversation every chance he could get.
Well, he was taunting you, I guess. Yeah.
So I went out, and I said, I'm going to... And in those days, it's really amazing because there were only two Kerouac books in print. I mean, now he's like a god in American literature.
Yeah.
In 1972, it was only On the Road and the Dharma Bums were the two books in print, and I thought, I'll read the one that's less famous just because that's who I am. I always go for the less famous. I always go for the underdog. So I read The Dharma Bums, and that book just it really knocked me on my rear end. The first five pages, he gets off a boxcar in Santa Barbara.
Sure.
He gives a piece of cheese to an old bum, and the bum gives him a prayer from St. Teresa. He goes down to the beach. He cooks his dinner in the sand. It's nighttime. He looks up at the stars after dinner, and he starts asking these first five pages, who put those stars up there? Why are they up there? Why am I down here? You know, what are they doing? What should I be doing? And I'm thinking, wow, this guy is asking the big questions about life because, the people they had been teaching in my college courses is the great American contemporary fiction writers were Saul Bellow, who's a good writer, Philip Roth, John Updike. With Updike, it's kind of like, peering into the windows of the upper middle class.
Well, and Cheever.
Cheever's a good writer, but
some
of it is like peeping Toms into the adulteries of the upper middle class. And here's a guy that's asking the big questions. Why are we on Earth? What are we supposed to be doing here?
Yeah.
So he had me from there. And, of course, as I read more of it, there was a lot of compassion for the lower classes, the underdogs,
no
the homeless,
question.
The prostitutes, the drug addicts, the people that nobody but our own Nelson Aldrin was writing about, but nobody else was writing about
Jerry,
in those
days. I think that's what first appealed to me about Kerouac, too, especially in On the Road, which I did read. I think I may have read it just before Kerouac died. He died in 69, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think I read it just before he died or when I heard he was sick or something. And I did find that kind of, his affinity for the same kind of Algren-esque kind of characters. But I certainly did not devote... You didn't fall in love with Kerouac, but you have ever been intrigued by Kerouac. And in 1979, as you write in the book, We Magazine, you call it a supposedly sophisticated spinoff from Playboy, asked you to do an article about the Kerouac revival. You found that there wasn't much of a Kerouac revival, didn't you?
They wanted me to focus on college campuses because supposedly that was their demographic. And I was calling. I had all this money, upfront money to call universities.
Sure.
I was calling universities all over the country. I think I found two or three courses that actually taught Kerouac. And, and the magazine said, sorry, you don't have a story. They gave me a kill fee, and that was it. And this was 79.
Yeah,
79. And, I mean, now, God, he's taught everywhere, almost everywhere.
Well, that's because the legacy, your book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century, is about not only the legacy of Jack Kerouac, but the abused legacy of Jack Kerouac. Is that putting it succinctly enough, Jerry Nicosia?
Well, yeah. I mean, I knew his real family. His daughter, Jan, was a very close friend of mine, and his nephew, who died about a year ago, Jack Kerouac's sister's son, Paul Blake Jr., was a good friend of mine. They were both working class people. Jan worked in corn canneries and dishwasher. Paul Blake Jr. was a carpenter. And these are the people that should have, we found out later, should have inherited his estate, which when he died was worth $91. But today is valued at something like $35 million.
Well, because these people...
They were cheated by a forged will.
A forged will that enabled another family to monetize Kerouac in what I find a disgusting kind of way. In this book, you write about, and I hate to even say it, but you write about the Lowell celebrates Kerouac event that takes place every year that I find an abomination, in part because, oh, well, why don't you have a Jack Kerouac burger with Jack Daniel's sauce, realizing that Jack Daniel's is a huge contributor to the death of Jack Kerouac. Who is that family, Jerry Nicosia?
It's the Sampas family. The whole story, it's kind of a tragic story because Jack Kerouac was dominated by his mother.
No question.
She was the only woman that really had a long-term, sustained control or powerful effect on his life. And when he would have a girlfriend, his mother would always interfere, and she called one girlfriend the witch, she called another girlfriend the savage, and she had all these pet names for his girlfriend. She really was a destructive influence in his life, and unfortunately he was never able to get out from under that influence. And when she had his mother had a stroke in 1966 and was paralyzed, and she refused to go into a nursing home. She said in her French Canadian accent, you know, Jackie, you have to take care of me at home. And this is the King of the Beats we're talking about. This is a guy that goes out on 2-week binges. There's no way he can be at home changing bedpans every day. He didn't know what to do. I found out later that he talked to family members. He asked some cousins if they could take care of her. Everybody had a full house. They all had, you know, aunts and kids to take care of, and nobody could take care of her. So he went to the older sister of a boyhood friend, Sammy Sampas, who died in World War II, who was the first poet Jack knew in Lowell. Was a good kid, died in the war. But he had an older, so-called old maid sister, and he said to Stella, would you take care of my mother? And she said, well, yeah, but I'm a good Greek girl. You have to marry me for me to do that. And he married this woman to take care of his mother, the worst reason to get married.
Yeah.
And it wasn't working out at all. I mean, she would she thought a writer was supposed to sit home and type from 9 to 5 every day. And Jack would, you know, he'd go out on binges, and she had like 8 brothers in Lowell, and she'd send her brothers out to catch him and bring him home. And they took his clothes so that he couldn't go out. He went out in his pajamas and got arrested for, you know, indecent exposure. It wasn't working. And 3 years later, he was trying to file for divorce, but he died sudden hemorrhage from cirrhosis of the liver. He was drinking himself to death.
You know, you make
and so
go ahead. You make
he, well, he had disinherited her. He was about to divorce her, but the divorce hadn't gone through. He made a will leaving everything to his mother, and he said, if she dies, I want my nephew, my sister's son, to get everything, because I want, as the last letter he wrote the day before he died, I want someone of my bloodline to take care of my archives. Well, he died. The old woman, his mother, was paralyzed, never went anywhere. They kept her in bed for 3 or 4 years, and when she died, they made out that the Sampas family made the will and left everything to themselves.
Yeah, it's a forgery. And the will is a forgery.
It was a forgery, but nobody saw that will for 20 years. It was hidden. When Jan finally saw the will, she said, my grandmother's name is misspelled, and it was. She took them to court, but she at the time was dying of kidney failure. Jan died at the age of 44 in 1996. She never saw the case go to trial, and Jack's nephew, his sister's son, carried the case. And these people that had the estate, the Sampases, had now millions of dollars for the best lawyers, and they stalled it and stalled it. It took years and years to finally go to trial. It was finally proven that it was a forgery, and then they came up with a Florida so-called non-claim statute, a statute of limitations, which says that if you inherit something in Florida, if no one complains within two years, you can keep it.
Right.
And so Stella had meanwhile died, his widow, and left everything to her brothers and sisters. This was 4 years later. The brothers and sisters said, well, hey, under Florida law, we inherited this stuff 4 years ago. Nobody complained in time, so we get to keep it. And so they're keeping what has been proven to have been, as you can look it up on the Internet, it's proven to have been a stolen inheritance.
Well, and also they have what they did to you, and I want to get into that, too, a little bit, because you wrote, when I think it was my father who gave me Memory Babe in 1983, shortly after it was published, and I thought, and I was a huge Kerouac fan, and it is, to my mind, the definitive Kerouac biography. It's out of print, isn't it, because of these Sampas people, right?
Absolutely. The book was it was originally published by Grove Press in 1983,
right.
And then it went to Viking Penguin, and it was a Viking Penguin book in 85 to 90, I guess. And it was a small size book, very tiny print. It's 800-page book, so you know when you got a 5x7 book with all that print, it's very tiny. And so they were talking about, we'll do a bigger, it's what they call a quality paperback, large size. We're going to do a new edition, more photographs, larger type. And then one day I get a call on the phone. You know, I'm ready to provide the photos for this brand new edition, and I get a call from David Stanford, who was the beat editor at Viking Penguin. By the way, we're putting your book out of print.
You know?
I mean, I pretty much fell over. I mean, because I'm expecting a new edition to come out. And Viking Penguin has been reissuing a lot of Kerouac books. I said, you're putting my book out of print? Yeah, there's no interest in Kerouac right now.
Ugh.
And I'm like, what have you been smoking?
Who are you
what
talking
have you been
to? Yeah.
And it turns out, it all came out later, that they had just made a six-book deal with John Sampas for six unpublished Kerouac books, and part of the deal was to throw Memory Babe out of Viking Penguin. And I subsequently brought it over to University of California Press, and they did a nice edition.
Yeah, they did.
But they have put so much pressure on the book that it was finally put out of print at University of California Press, too. They've taken my name out of all the bibliographies. You can go to any Viking Penguin book, and you will look at the list of Kerouac biographies and those bibliographies, and you will not see a mention of Gerald Nicosia or Memory Babe, even though people around the world know it's the definitive book on Kerouac.
No kidding. The latest book is Kerouac, The Last Century, and I will continue on my conversation with Jerry Nicosia. You miss Chicago at all, Jerry? You must miss.
Tremendously. Yeah, Chicago is my hometown. It will always be. It's there in my heart, you know.
I know. Well, I want to talk. We'll talk a little bit more. I mean, the book reads like it's. I am not the first person to mention it. It reads like a novel. Which is a good thing, I think, and it sets the record really straight, and it's in some ways it's Kafka-esque in some ways, Jerry. I'll leave you to sit with that for 2 minutes while we get a commercial break in. I'm ready.
Okay.
It's Kafka-esque. I mean, it makes me want to never go to Florida. Certainly makes me never want to go in a Florida courtroom. I'll tell you that. We'll be right back. Gerald Nicosia has spent more 50 years of his life, more or less, studying and thinking about Jack Kerouac, and I think in very powerful ways, fighting for the legacy and the meaning of Jack Kerouac in his amazing book that I have not read in years, but I will never forget it. Memory Babe is, to my mind, the definitive biography of Jack Kerouac. About it, Allen Ginsberg said, Memory Babe is a monument to Kerouac, smells and tastes like Kerouac, has a powerful impact and a mountain of life detail I'd forgotten. He calls it a great book. But because of the legal wrangling and the greed of a family that illegally, with a forged will, got possession of all of Kerouac's papers and everything else, the Kerouac life and image and reputation has been sullied, I think, beyond words. And Jerry Nicosia captures all that in his latest book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. They monetized this man, did they not, Jerry?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, we could spend a whole show talking about that, but among the worst things that they did was selling off of his papers piece by piece, breaking up his archive piecemeal to collectors and dealers all over the world. You know, he pioneered this thing. He was a fast typist of typing because they didn't have computers in those days. He wanted to get a jazz flow, a nonstop flow in his writing, so he would type nonstop on long 120-foot rolls of paper. The first ones he taped together, but after that he just went out and bought teletype rolls. He said it was easier. Feed the teletype roll into the typewriter and type 100 words a minute nonstop for three days or 3 weeks and have a book. These were phenomenal. They were breakthrough works. All of those, there were 9 of his books were written on rolls of paper. All of those were sold into private hands. The only one we know about is the one Jim Irsay, the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, has.
$2.5 million or something, right?
He occasionally puts it in $2.5 million. He occasionally puts it in a glass case and lets people look at it, but that's not really being able to study it. The other 8 rolls, we don't even know where they are. And plus notebooks were sold and letters were sold and all kinds of other things. That archive will never be put back together again. That alone was a terrible thing.
It won't be put back together. It will certainly not be accessed by scholars and biographers, because they seem in the business of doling out information and or access to Kerouac stuff to those willing to pay for it. They have no, you know, whether someone is trying to make a movie or trying to write a book, what has been their reaction, this family, this weird family, to your book, Jerry?
Oh, well, they haven't given me any official reaction. John Sampas, who was the executor after Stella died, he was the youngest brother of Stella, and he ran the show for many years and did a lot of really bad things, I think, in terms of Kerouac scholarship. He died about 2 years ago. His nephew is running things now, and his nephew doesn't have the acerbic nature. I mean, John Sampas, you know, he would call me a piece of trash.
He was a nasty person.
Jim Sampas is a very diplomatic person. He, you know, he's smiled at me every time he's seen me. He doesn't say much, but he's also working the deals. As far as I can tell, he's just making deals hand over fist for Kerouac properties. So I don't see any attempt to really enhance Kerouac scholarship. I see a continued attempt to make as much. And of course, they sell Kerouac's image everywhere they possibly can. I mean, you'll see Kerouac's face on backpacks and T-shirts and keychains. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, another character who comes off to my mind as a bad person is the legendary agent Sterling Lord, doesn't he?
Well, yes. You know, the thing is, Jan Kerouac, who I told you, Jack's daughter, was working in corn canneries and dishwashing. She didn't realize that by copyright law, by United States copyright law, she was supposed to have been getting 50% of her father's royalties. And she finally found this out when she was about 35 years old, because she was dishwashing in Boulder, Colorado, and she ran into John Steinbeck IV, John Steinbeck's son, also a troubled young guy who died young. But he told her, he said, "Oh, Jan, you know, John Steinbeck IV, why are you dishwashing? Why aren't you collecting those 50% of the royalties the copyright law says you're supposed to get?" And she says, "What? Nobody ever told me
that. Your father's books are still selling 500,000 copies a year."
And so she got a series of, she had to get, you know, contingency lawyers because she had no money, just like the Blake family is poor.
Right.
And the lawyers kept writing to the Sampases, when are you going to give Jan her royalties? And 3 years later, they finally said, well, they realized that they were going to get in some legal trouble if they kept denying those royalties forever. They said, "Well, Jan, we've decided that we will let you have your 50% of the royalties if you sign this long agreement with us." And she had to sign this agreement that said, you know, that she would have their agent, Sterling Lord, become her agent forever. Well, this set up a conflict of interest, because how could their agent be doing a fair deal for her?
Slightly.
And the irony is, Rick, she didn't have to sign that. The law said she was entitled to those royalties.
Of course, sure.
But they conned her. They basically said, you can get this if you sign this. It's like if I say to you, Rick, well, Rick, I'll let you drive your car if you send me $500,000. You know, and it's like, your car, why can't you drive it? You don't have to pay me for it.
But they
got her to sign this agreement. And so Sterling Lord, every time there was an issue of money, he would always side with the Sampases because he was their agent.
Because they were the cash register. Yeah. You have to be. I just think this is a remarkable book. It is spooky, and it is the truth, and it is. I hope for his, well, with all of his, so many things being sold off, and is there any hope for Kerouac to attain some level that is not a face on keychains and T-shirts?
Well, you know, there's still
the Blake
family.
I'll tell you that.
There's still Jack's sister's family. Now, Paul, who is Jack's nephew, who's in a lot of the books as Little Luke, called Little Luke, Little Paul in the book.
Yeah.
He died a year ago, but he has a son who's now 43, and he has children. They live in they're poor, dirt poor. They live in a trailer in Arizona. The thing is, now, you know, this Florida statute of limitations has protected the Sampases on the will, but the Sampases have also claimed the image rights, which I don't think they have a right to. They got all this other stuff through the will, and then the will was protected because nobody complained within 2 years. But they've also said, we own image rights. Is like with a famous person, James Dean, you control the face, you control the name.
Yeah, it's like a Michael Jordan.
They say, yes, we control this too, and they're the ones who are making all this money selling, you know. They even had a Kerouac whiskey, which is really tasteless.
That's disgusting.
But the thing is, I believe that that, and if there's any lawyers listening out there, somebody should help the Blake family, because I think the Blakes, they're the closest blood relatives of Jack's sister's descendants. They should be controlling the image rights, and they're good people. I can swear to you, they're working class people, as I was, you know, good working class people. They would be doing a much better job. So, but the thing is, they have no money for a lawyer.
For a
if somebody
lawyer.
Can get in touch with me, I can put them in touch with the Blakes. But I think that legally, those image rights, because from what I know of image rights, they're supposed to descend to the blood family, not,
I agree.
Not to
I think
a family
right.
that gets an estate through a fake will. You know.
Well, it's great. You dedicate this book to Paul Blake Jr., Paul Blake III, and their whole blessed Kerouac family. Jerry Nicosia, this is just a remarkable piece of work. I know your heart and soul is in it, too. How's it? What's been the reaction, not from the Sampas family?
Well, interesting. There have been a number of good reviews and a number of good radio interviews. A number of the big publications, Publishers Weekly, refused to review it.
Yeah.
A number of Kirkus refused to review it. I really believe there's been some pressure put on, because you have to understand, those Kerouac contracts that the Sampases have put at Viking Penguin are generating millions of dollars.
Oh, no question.
For agents, for foreign editions. There's a lot of people that don't want to see this apple cart overturned,
sure.
you know, or there's any monkey wrench thrown into this process. But there's a lot of people that have seen the book have spoken out for it. So it's been a battle, because, you know, with not having the big reviews like Publishers Weekly, it's a problem getting the book known. But nevertheless, I'm getting some people that are responding very positively to the book. And by the way, thank you, and thank your father too, because your father said some very nice things about Memory Babe.
Yeah, he
and I want to say something right here. You know, as a Chicago writer, I've always been something of an outsider to the system. I think most Chicago writers can identify with me saying that right now.
Yeah,
and that's one of the reasons I identified with Kerouac, because
sure.
he was this French-Canadian kid coming from Lowell to New York, and he felt the icy shoulder.
No question.
And, you know, Chicago writers also don't get the respect and don't get the warm welcome. But Chicago has always supported its own writers, its own arts community, and I've always had great support, and thank you tonight. But from people in Chicago have always been there to support me as a Chicago writer, and that means a lot, because, you know, you don't always get that from the other places.
No, well, I enjoy doing it, and I enjoy reading you, and I enjoy knowing you, and the Kerouac story goes on. Come back for a visit, Jerry. I'd be very curious to see what you think of your old hometown now. But do keep in touch, Jerry, and if I can massage a piece at the Tribune, I'm going to try to do that, too, because it's a fascinating story. Again, the title of the book is Kerouac, in the last quarter century. It's heartbreaking on a number of levels to me, especially because, Jerry, the last years of Jack Kerouac's life, when you sort of make the assumption here that he committed slow suicide because he was Roman Catholic and didn't want to do it the conventional way, so he kind of drank himself to death, and what has happened after his death is equally tragic. Jerry, it's always good to talk to you, and it's always a pleasure to read you.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate it being here tonight.
I'll be in touch.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Great.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I'm sure for many of you, the book On the Road had a big, big impact. And Kerouac still, got T-shirts, a bottle of booze. It's just incredible. Roy Coleman, thanks for getting him on the phone and shepherding this whole show. Dan Long, thanks for all you do here. Roger Badish is wandering the halls, and I appreciate all of you listening.